I saw it in my Lily White suburb. So as you can imagine, had a couple people walking out of the film. I think one of the things that was great.
What are they kind of expecting?
Yeah, right?
Come on.
Listen, what's so great is that, you know, I'm like, okay, I don't know what you thought you were going to get, but you absolutely got it. So whatever.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 39, and I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian. And I'm joined by my nondescript, Ebony Astor.
I don't like it.
And Carolyn Pettit.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't pick me out of a crowd. Totally nondescript.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, where the feminist killjoys come in for your media, depending on your perspective.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. In today's show, we're going to talk about Spike Lee's latest film, Black Klansman. And as always, we'll finish the show by sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Hey, Caro, did you know that Feminist Frequency is run on crowdfunding?
I think I did know that. But I think a lot of people don't know that.
They don't.
Yes.
But those people can help us keep bringing the show to you every week.
Yeah.
By joining our podcast community. Plus, you'll get special perks like bonus segments, AMAs, and more. You can learn more at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. What's up, y'all?
So, you were in Vegas.
Yes. I mean, I was in many places recently. But yes, I was in Vegas.
Yeah.
Partying hard.
Of course.
Just slots,
that's
all day, every
that's
day.
That's the slots. Only reason to go to Vegas.
That is the saddest thing I've ever heard, Anita. Partying all day, and then you followed up with slots. Like,
Like, I don't know. There's something for me deeply depressing when I go to Vegas and I see people just, like, in front of the slot machine, like, smoking cigarettes, just, like, feeding quarters in for hours. I don't know. I find it pretty depressing.
Yeah. Well, so I went to Vegas for personal reasons.
Yes.
And so and I've gone there a few times.
You can tell people that's where your parole officer is located, Anita.
Ebony.
Like, you should just put it all out on the table.
So, but it's so funny because the rest of Vegas is like just the suburbs.
Yeah. The Strip, which is like wild, like, you know, it's a bajillion lights crammed into like 20 square feet of space. And then outside of that, it's just like,
it's just suburbs. Yeah. And so like you don't go to the Strip if you live there.
Right.
But I did have a really delicious lavender vanilla iced tea. Just in case anyone was wondering.
In Vegas.
In Vegas.
Okay.
They have a...
Are you going to tell
lavender,
us where it was?
Lavender
or do people just do their own research?
Sorry. It was at a spot called Public Us. Also, I missed last week because I was at Gen Con.
Right.
Which is a big role-playing board game
conference.
Yeah, it's massive.
Yeah, in
that was fun.
In Indianapolis. Yeah. You played a bunch of board games.
No, I didn't actually.
Well, okay, but it seemed like every time I would check our Instagram stories, you know, there'd be something about you. About you playing this game with with these cool people or that game with those cool people. So yeah, you kind of did.
I did. I did some live streams of games.
Yeah,
so that was fun.
Yeah,
You know,
neat.
Yeah.
All right.
What do you got for us this week,
Carol? We haven't really talked about video game news for a while, and I figured, you know, boy, this week sure gives us an opportunity to talk about some video game news. So, right now, probably the biggest sensation on Twitch is a streamer who goes by the moniker of Ninja. His real name is Tyler Blevins. He's a 27-year-old white guy, super good at Fortnite, which is the biggest, you know, one of the biggest games on the planet right now. And he's married, and a story came out on Polygon about how Ninja has announced, or has a policy, I should say. He has a policy of not streaming with female Twitch streamers.
A policy?
A policy.
Like, written in stone?
Pretty much,
Who the fuck is this asshole?
So, now, the thing is that I honestly believe that Ninjas has no critique of, like, larger systems or sexism, and that for him, it's just an ignorant choice that he didn't think through how it would, like, harm women, but it's sure sparked a whole lot of conversation on Twitter these past several days. So, to quote from the story, the news story on Polygon, right? I don't play with female gamers, says Tyler Ninja Blevins. If I have one conversation with one female streamer when we're playing with one another, and even if there's a hint of flirting, that is going to be taken and going to be put on every single video and be clickbait forever. Not being connected to other women online, that was something I made 100% sure. It's for him, as he says it, it's about like devotion to his wife and not wanting his wife to like have to deal with.
Oh, can he not have women in the same room? Does he call his wife mother?
Is this like a Mike Pence situation?
So, you know, it's. I really do think it's just a decision made out of ignorance, but the material harm done to it, the way that it normalizes discrimination against women, and the way that it just keeps women out of certain cultural spaces when men who are dominant in those spaces say, you know, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to associate with women, is certainly that's very real.
Yeah, it's that gross kind of paternalist, you know, benevolent sexism, right? That's like, this is for your own good. It's because I honor my own partner so much that I'm choosing not to engage with, I don't know, the legions of succubi who are apparently just littered about Twitch, you know, ready to entrap the unwary male gamer.
It's female disgusting. Sexuality is so dangerous. I can't, you know, be expected to like to resist or something. Yeah,
it's gross because the idea also is that you like, if you're a dude, you can get away with doing something like that, and it. In many cases, no one would probably ever know, right? Like, unless, you know, someone points it out or you take pains to point it out.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many, you know, dude gamers, other dude gamers that you can stream with. You know, you have the ability to make this choice, right? And have it be, like, logistically possible in a way that, like, no one ever questions.
Yes. And, I mean, he's not wrong that when and if he does interact with female streamers, that there's going to be comments, there's going to be inappropriate reactions to that, but that doesn't mean that the answer is to
not in the way he is assuming. There, it's going to be sexist and misogynist toward, and racist depending on the woman, towards her. Mm-hmm. Not, he's worried about like this reminds me of the dudes who have been coming out around Me Too stuff being like, well, I don't know how to flirt,
right?
Or I can't pick up women, or I can't, like, fucking what hit Cavill's stupid comment, you know, like that's what this reminds me of a lot. And like, I'm real tired of dudes like who don't know how to be fucking decent human beings and feel persecuted and like, come on. Right.
So, I mean, at least there's again, like I said, I mean, at least there's a big conversation around this. I'm sure that that's going to get back to Ninja in one way or another. He can't be oblivious to the fact that people have very strong feelings about his comments, and people have arguments as to why those comments are not harmful to women who are trying to make a name for themselves in that space as well. So
I gotta say, when this story started popping up over Twitter this weekend, it was one of those instances where I immediately felt so old and so out of it, because in a single 280 character tweet,
right,
I caught the reference for like every 17th word, and I was like, who? And what's his job?
Right.
And he's not doing what? And he plays what game? I was I need several Wikipedia links to just break down this whole thing. I should not be allowed out of the house. I should just stay in my lane, eat my food, and do my quilting, because I don't know shit about what's going on with y'all youths.
So there's that. And, you know, I guess I'll quickly touch on as well. A very important story was written at Kotaku by Cecilia D'Anastasio about the culture of the pervasive culture of sexism at Riot Games. Her story included anecdotes, including this one. One day, Lacey, a female employee, not her real name, conducted an experiment. After an idea she really believed in fell flat during a meeting, she asked a male colleague to present the same idea to the same group of people days later. He was skeptical, but she insisted that he give it a shot. Lo and behold, the week after that, he went in, presented exactly as I did, and the whole room was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. His face turned beet red and he had tears in his eyes, said Lacey. They just didn't respect women. And that's just a very small anecdote, one piece of a very long, deep, multifaceted story about the culture, the kind of toxic culture of sexism that has persisted at Riot. I mean, I believe that, and I, you know, that there are good people at Riot, of course, who are working, trying to work from the inside to improve the culture there. But nonetheless, the reality is that many women have been driven out or been marginalized within that space because of this culture.
Yeah, it's, highly recommend reading the article.
Yeah.
It's a little brutal. And it just reminds you of how far we haven't come.
Yeah.
At all. And it's, yeah.
So. Yeah, I was reading that piece, I was struck by the way in which the patriarchy and white supremacy, the insidious ways and often unconscious ways they replicate themselves generation after generation, right? In particular, this thing called culture fit. So it is highly likely that, you know, under the guise of, oh, we don't think that, you know, this woman is a particular fit at Riot because she's not a gamer. Well, then it turns out she is a gamer. You know, she's an avid game player. Oh, well, she doesn't play the right kind of games. Like, there's always these shifting goalposts, right, in the name of culture fit that just go completely uninterrogated. And so, you know, companies that say, oh, we are actively trying to recruit, you know, like a diverse workforce. Nevertheless, what they're looking for are these carbon copies of the people who already exist. And so, you know, there's no way that someone who's outside of that arena, you know, is ever going to be able to break in because of this nebulous thing that no one can actually define. And when you try and pin it down, the goalposts keep shifting.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear from the story that Riot has put an emphasis on historically, like a very, I mean, male-oriented brand of what it means to be a gamer. One woman reports that during, I think, an interview for a job, she was asked, I hate even repeating this because it's so gross, how big is your E-peen, which is like, how much of like a dominant, like, fucking gamer are you, right? Other women, you know, they might have like 12 consoles attached to their TV and still like don't fit the definition of gamer that someone at Riot is looking for. A producer at one point during a talk to the employees was like, here at Riot Games, we hire gamers. If you're not a core gamer, you need to over-index in another area. I don't give a shit. You're better if you're a gamer. And
yeah, that stuck out at me the most, that I thought was incredibly damaging and unique. Like, the other stuff is just like sexism in so many workplaces here. And this has its own place in other industries. But in gaming, it is like you have to prove your gaming cred. And if you don't, then you aren't a cultural fit, like Ebony was saying.
Right.
And I think that's incredibly damaging for so many reasons. And I brought this up recently. I was consulting at a game studio and, you know, they're like, how do we create experiences for a larger audience and new folks? And how do we make sure we stay on top of it? And I brought this up because I was like, hiring people with different levels of experience in games who might not know anything about games, who know games really well, will give you these amazingly different perspectives that can only help you make your experiences better. But a lot of people don't see it that way. They see it as like, you're not as good as them because you're not as good of a gamer. And I'm like, bleh! Mm-hmm. Let's just puke everywhere on that one. are we going to talk about Idris Elba?
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. So
I guess I feel like we need to address this.
All right. Absolutely. Sure.
Do you like
you were expecting that to be item number one on the agenda, weren't you?
A little bit.
So fans for, you know, Bond fans and Idris Elba fans and, you know, a lot of people for many years have been advocating for Idris Elba to be the next James Bond. And now rumors within Hollywood are swirling that he is sort of the top pick to be the next James Bond.
How do we feel about this?
I mean, I'm of the opinion that, like, can we just bid James Bond farewell as the kind of irredeemably sexist kind of throwback character that he is? I mean, but it's sort of like if the reality is that we are going to keep making James Bond movies, which I'm, you know, which of course it fucking is the reality, then yeah, it's better.
I know, it's like,
better. It's sort of like when we're in the video game space, when it's like, well, yeah, I mean, there may be like super violent shooters that at their core just don't reflect like my values, but do I want women and stuff in those games? I mean, yeah, of course I do, because like that's better in a sense. I mean, it depends. These are super complex conversations, and I can't do a decent job of summing it up in the 30 seconds that we have here, but I mean, I lean toward that. Yes, we should get Idris Elba in that role.
It makes white supremacists mad. So on that level, I'm for it.
Yeah.
On the other side, I'm like, I'm really wildly uncomfortable with this black man being the face of
misogyny
empire.
Yeah.
In the state.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and I mean, like, you know, as someone on Twitter pointed out, like, I'm going to be, you know, real upset to see Idris Elba like blowing shit up and killing people in the global south, because you know that's going to happen at some point if he makes it into a movie. So, yeah, I really wish.
Yeah, Ebony, I think you only mentioned it on the bonus last week, but it was so fascinating. I really wish we'd gotten to talk more in regard to Mission Impossible about Angela Bassett, a black mm-hmm. woman as the face and voice of the CIA.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, that's just so politically thorny and fascinating.
That actually happens a lot. I feel like that's something we could dive into in future episodes, because that happens a lot. And it's another way to sort of segregate black folks into like power roles, but not important. I didn't watch Mission Impossible, so I don't know that. But I see that on TV a lot, where you have like the cop boss, but he's not the star of the show, but he's like the black dude in charge.
Exactly.
Yeah. I also, really quick before we move on, I just want to say that, remember how Daniel Craig, who currently plays James Bond, was like, yeah, he's a super big misogynist.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of like, but like, it's just this weird, like, you still play him, but you acknowledge this. And so we're still just skirting around the like historical tradition of James Bond, instead of being like, either revamp the character entirely or like, let's do away with this shit. So I don't know, man. It's frustrating.
Yes,
all right.
It is.
Let's move on to the main topic this week, which is totally not frustrating at all. Spike Lee is back with another visionary film diving into just how racist this country really is. Black Klansman is set in the early 1970s and is based on the true story of Ron Stallworth, the first black cop in Colorado Springs Police Department. He pairs up with a white cop and they go undercover to expose the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really liked this movie, and I totally get we'll get into the political problems, the frustrating political problems with it, but I want to start by saying something that I went in not expecting about this film that I really appreciated about it, is, so it opens with a shot of Gone with the Wind. It deals heavily with the impact that Birth of a Nation had on people. It engages directly with images from blaxploitation films, right? You have a character who, at one point, a black woman character, who says that, well, Superfly is a pimp, right? He, like, that image hurts our people, while other people would find that image kind of empowering and revolutionary. I loved that this film engages directly with, like, the imagery of cinema and acknowledges like the tremendous power that these images have to shape cultural attitudes and ideas and sentiment, right? To foment rage, hatred, and so on. And it does that on so many levels. Like, and it takes that beyond cinema. There's a shot at a church where Ron Stallworth, the black cop, like looks up at the plate glass window, and it's like these white figures are, you know, on the church window, and so it's just constantly like engaging with the imagery of race and racism and white supremacy and all of that. So I thought that was really great.
I think like the way that this film advocates for an engaged media literacy was really powerful. So, you know, as you say, Caro, the opening shot from Gone with the Wind, the insertion of Birth of a Nation. But there's this, the way that Black Klansman shows you the construction of a white fantasy of both domination and victimization through the media, I thought was really powerful. And I think, you know, in our in the opening of the film, when we see Alec Baldwin's speech, you know, and the sort of inauthenticity of that speech as it is built and like recreated and reframed and performed, you know, just to emphasize the way in which, you know, this messaging is going out and has to be shaped a certain way to have the intended effect, which, as we see throughout the film, is in fact, it does get its intended effects. You know, it does reach the audience that it's meant to reach. It does provoke them into behaving the way that it wants them to behave. And so I think this is a film that, you know, is kind of, it's self-aware in that way about the way that, you know, the way messaging is created, and wants the audience to be engaged with that as well.
Real quick, Didn't Alec Baldwin have a racist... didn't he shout some racist shit to a reporter few years back? Or am I...
Maybe. I don't know if it was him or Mel Gibson. Like, Alec Baldwin
did his own stuff, but
There was a voicemail message of Alec Baldwin to, like, his daughter or something that had some vile shit in it, but I don't know that it had racist stuff in it.
I think there was, like, some racist slurs to a reporter.
Maybe.
But I don't remember. So the whole time I saw him on screen saying this, I kept being like, that's an interesting casting choice.
Yeah.
Am I misremembering this situation that happened?
Right.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah,
sorry,
the casting across the board was... just like so interesting in this film. First of all, like, just the family connections, right? So you have Ron Stallworth, played by John David Washington, Denzel Washington's son, who sounds so much like Denzel sometimes, it's uncanny, you know, like just certain phrasings. But then, like, Michael Buscemi, Steve Buscemi's brother.
I thought that was actually Steve Buscemi.
That's the thing, right? So, like, I'm watching and I'm like, this is such a Steve Buscemi kind of character. I gotta know who this actor is. Turns out it's his brother, Michael Buscemi, you know? And then, like, Nicholas Turturro, John Turturro's brother, you know, pops up. And to be honest, I found his placement in the film a bit weird. And I'm not sure that I found that to be his insertion to be, you know, entirely successful. I think, you know, Spike Lee might have been trying to make a point about kind of the strange bedfellows, you know, that collapse into bed together under the cause of white supremacy. But I'm not sure that Nicholas Turturro as the one of the conspirators in the bombing was as successful as it could have been.
For me, the most interesting casting choice, probably, and I think a really smart one, was Topher Grace as David Duke, because Topher Grace, like, as a performer, he projects a kind of likability in a way, right? And so you have, like, by having him in this role, it really drives home that hate is not always, like, movie bad guys, right? I mean, he appears, like, friendly, smart, like, kind of goofy and harmless, but that is in and of itself a tactic of hate. And one of David Duke's tactics of hate is to present, you know, white supremacy as, like, the civil, friendly, like, it's all about optics, so that, and it's so effective to this day, because that, it positions those who are persecuted and have to resist, it makes them look like the agitators, the violent ones disrupting, you know, the peace of these, like, basically friendly people. And I thought Topher Grace's casting was really effective.
I was I'm very indifferent to Adam Driver in life.
I love him.
Do you? The first time I saw him was on the one episode of Girls I watched, and I've just been indifferent to him ever since. I really liked him in this movie. I really liked that, the way he played that character, and I thought that I really liked the storyline around, like, this is So they are both anti, the Klan is both anti-Semitic and racist. And the Adam Driver's character Flip is Jewish. And so he's pretending to not be Jewish. But there's a whole section where real Ron is like,
right.
is like, why don't you care more about this? They hate you too.
Yeah, you're acting like you don't have skin in the game.
Yeah. And Flip's character, like, you know, a few scenes later is like, I've been thinking a lot about this because, like, I'm Jewish, but I wasn't raised Jewish. It doesn't mean anything to me. And, like, he's been dealing with identity and what that means in lieu of the fact that he's been actively, like, acting racist towards his own people for this job.
Yeah. It's a story, to some extent, of a political or personal awakening for both men. I mean, because, Ron is inescapably black, but, you know, he has never fully politically engaged with the reality of, like, being a black person in a white supremacist culture. And it's like, there's like a weird moment where a white cop, and I don't know how I feel about this, actually. Like, I'm glad that Ron has to grow over the course of the story. I think that makes it more dramatic and instructive. But, like, The police department in this film seems borderline, like, utopian to an extent, that, like, there's a white cop who has to tell Ron, like, you don't think America could elect, like a white supremacist? You know, that's pretty naive coming from a black man. and like, the whole, like, okay, so Boots Riley, the director of Sorry to Bother You, tweeted... like, he tweeted, like, do we really need another film where the cops are presented as, like, the best way of dealing with racism? And, I mean, to its credit...
Sorry, I have to say, the reason I'm laughing, because that's going to be really weird, is that there was a person who replied to him. Yeah. I can't remember exactly what he said, but he was like, but blah, 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 have you seen Sorry to Bother You? Yeah. To Boots Riley, the creator of Sorry to Bother You. Just the fucking...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was hilarious. Obviously this film engages deeply with the police as an instrument of both, like, the film has the conversation, but it still does fall on the side of, like... of, like, the police being ultimately the heroes of the story.
And it's a super fair critique because, like, absolutely. You're following, like you're saying, it's this utopian space. And, like, you have, spoilers, there's a cop that's quote-unquote, like, a dirty cop, and he's, like, racist. And it's almost like he's the only one, and nobody will call him out. And, like, nobody else is as bad as him. And so at the end, like, he gets his comeuppance or whatever.
And everybody cheers, you know, as if they weren't complicit in the fact that this dude still had a job.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the chief of police, like, is considered to be, or whatever he is, the head
captain,
cop, the captain,
whatever, yeah.
He's, like, is considered to be, like, this good guy that's like, yeah, I'm here to bring on the first black cop into the police force and all this shit. And then, you know, he's like, we have to cover up the fact that all of this happened. We can't go undercover anymore, blah, blah, blah. And then, but he's, like, perfectly happy to take down this dirty cop. It's just, the whole thing was like, let's tie this up with a bow.
Yeah.
One of the things that I found frustrating about this film, and I deeply enjoyed it, and I think there are parts of it that are so smart and so well done, but I did find it frustrating how Black Klansman attempts to have its cake and eat it too. In one of those ways, and the way this film is structured around the police. And so, yes, the police are the heroes, and to a certain extent, like the FBI, right? Because there's a moment when an FBI agent meets up with Ron Starworth and reveals that there's been a parallel investigation about the KKK and its membership at that organization. So although a character like Patrice, who is the president of the Colorado College Black Student Union and Ron's love interest, although her anti-police sort of, you know, like systemically grounded arguments about the police as an organization, about law enforcement as a system, although the film gives those arguments, you know, air, it doesn't really give them weight. And so at the end of the day, we are left to, you know, really blame bad actors for the horrible things that happen more so than whole movements and paradigms. And yet at the end, the film tries to suggest like, hey, you know, there is a larger problem here. Look, the Klan is still around. Neo-Nazis are still around. White supremacists are still around. But the film itself, the larger body of the film, is about isolating those bad actors, people like Felix in the Klan, right? You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's suggesting like if everybody in the Klan was as, you know, ineffectual or as, you know, ludicrous as Ivanhoe, it would be like a laughable organization. It is laughable, but it's still a hate organization. It's still dangerous. It's not just the Felixes we need to watch out for. Like Walter is not a sympathetic character simply because he's a quieter racist, you know?
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And I think they do, one of the ways that they contribute to that portrayal is that they position the cops as the center and the moral correct, like the morally right middle, and the BSU and the black activists as the extreme left, and that the Klan is the extreme right. And that is really troubling, even though I know that that's not the intention of it. And one of the ways that that really, like, it finally sunk in for me that that's what they were doing is at the near the end when they show the Birth of the Nation screening and they talk about how Birth of the Nation was shown at the White House and how it, like, really resuscitated the Klan and created them and all of this stuff. You see those white folks chanting white power, and it is immediately contrasted with black folks chanting black power, and it's given equal weight in the filmmaking context.
Yeah, the juxtaposition is so fucked up there. It's so fucked up because the film is trying to, you know, like, it's through its proximity, you know, in that narrative space, it's like you say, you know, presenting them as like, you know, sort of opposing roughly equal forces, you know, with sort of opposite intent. And so even though the film also tries to suggest that the black power movement is based upon XYZ, which is fundamentally different than the white power movement, you know, by sheer fact that you have that juxtaposition, I think works to cancel out, you know, for me anyway, work to cancel out, you know, its intent to say like, no, these are not the same.
I don't know. I mean, I see 100% what both of you are saying. I don't think that we can hear the horrifying story that Harry Belafonte tells in this film and think that these are, I don't know. I didn't read it that way.
Here's the thing is I would say, that
like, I think our sympathies are absolutely 100% supposed to be with.
I think yours are.
Well, I'm not saying, yeah, it may be an error in directorial choice, but I don't think that Spike Lee's intention or the film's intention was to actually present
sure,
them as
equal. But we know intention
equal.
Doesn't matter.
No, sure.
So I think that I agree 100%. Not knowing Spike Lee, he definitely was not intending it for it to come off that way. And I assume that he thinks that his audience is already a sympathetic audience in this case, so that could work. But like the Black Panther movement and the Black Power movement, especially like the visuals of that time and the language of that time are thought of as so radical in a bad way.
Yeah.
So like extreme and over the top. And they lean into all of it in this film in terms of the visuals, the language, like, and the characters that we identify with, which is Ron Stallworth being like, you know, he sort of waffles. He's like, well, I don't like calling them pigs.
Right.
And like, and you don't really see him growing from that. I didn't see a significant amount
right.
of like him becoming more radicalized.
It was frustrating. The final scene between him and Patrice is still her being like, so are you going to resign from the police department? And he's like, I don't know. You know, I mean, I always wanted to be a cop. And that's basically where we leave those two characters, is in that unresolved and seemingly unresolvable political state of difference.
Yeah.
And yet I don't feel that the film does leave it unresolved. I think there's at least an implicit assumption that Patrice has come to accept it and that we should accept Ron's position.
Maybe.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, as a member of the police, because, you know, they have that quiet moment in what I believe is his apartment. And then there's that fantastic scene where they hear a noise outside and they both arm up, right? And the visual we get is like the like a movie poster or a still shot from a blaxploitation film, right? Of the of them with their guns drawn and the so I'm not sure what it's called, but it's like the trolley shot of them, mm-hmm. you know, advancing on a window. And we see the Klan arrayed outside, burning a cross, and then I just feel like the film leaves us still with the idea that, okay, you may not like the police, but thank God there's a force out there, you know, like them working to protect people. And I just, on its face, I disagree with that. But that's a personal reaction. Like I said, I think Patrice's arguments are given air in the film, but I just don't think they're given weight.
Yeah. Oh, that's a really good way of describing that. Oh, Ebony, you're such a smarty pants. I'd like to talk about the women for a minute, because we, in the last episode I was on, we talked about how there's these great films that are coming out about race that are centering, like, you know, systemic issues, and women are sort of sidelined in them. And this happens in this film again, or I feel like it does. The only two women in this film are Patrice, the head of the BSU, and the wife that really, that is like talked over Connie, and dismissed. Yeah. And yeah. The way that she's framed and every, except she really, really wants to contribute to the Klan's goals.
So, I mean, I think with her storyline, like, I think that the film did need to center women more. I think it should have done that via Patrice and or other characters. I think that the story of Felix's wife works because it's about how women are kind of like within that white supremacist space, of course, like patriarchy and sexism are flourishing. But we hear her say at one point to Felix, like, thank you for bringing me into your life, and thank you for giving me like a sense of purpose. And I think that, like so many people come to movements like white supremacy because they, like, lack any sense of, like, purpose in their lives. And it gives them some sense of purpose. And, like, finding ways to give people a sense of meaning and purpose is part of what movements of people who have left white supremacist movements and are trying to get other people out of those movements are trying to do, right? Because they understand how powerful that can be.
I also think that her role, yes, agreed. But I also think that her role is part of showing how complicit white women are.
In white supremacy, 100%. Yeah. Like, white supremacy does not, right. White women have always been complicit in white supremacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a way that you could argue that the putting on a pedestal, like the cult of true womanhood, right, you know, and the valorization of white femininity has always been at the root of, you know, certain of the more virulent, you know, behaviors and beliefs of white supremacy. But it's always a fiction, right? Like, it's not actually about the white women it claims to be about. So you have these white women who are kept entirely separate from their husbands, their brothers, their fathers, whatever, who are being inducted into the Klan, for instance, at that key scene in the, like, shabby lodge. They have their induction ceremony. So they're kept entirely separate from the ceremony until they're let in at the end. And then when there's this ceremonial dinner, they have to sit in entirely different spaces. So even though there's this, you know, grand fiction that it's all about the women and protecting white women from rapacious black men, nevertheless, like, the white men who claim to be their biggest offenders aren't even in close proximity to them most of the time. It's never really about them. And yet the white women who are part of it have bought into it wholesale, right? You know, and position themselves as needing the defense from their white partners and white male family members. Because it's a powerful, it's the only place for them. And it offers the only kind of power they can have in that space.
We sort of talked about this earlier, but I think it's important to point out that the relevancy of this film to today and how the movie is very specific about that. Like, there are a number of lines in it that reference our current political climate. And you know, like there's some really good lines, like with the right white man, we can do anything, or for America to achieve its greatness. You know, can you imagine like talking about how David Duke's like taking off the robes in order to gain office, which he did, and in order for like the White House to take over and spread hate through those means. And like that's what happened. And so when the end came around and I was like, what are they going to do?
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Amy framed Nick for her own murder.
They have this happy ending, right? Like the spoilers, the Klan blow the bad Klan members, which is complicated, blow themselves up. The racist cop gets caught. You know, like there's this celebration that, you know, David Duke gets told that the scene where Ron is on the phone and he's doing the R thing about how like David Duke's like black people talk, like that shit was hilarious. But I was like, oh my God, you can't end like this. That's weird. And they didn't. They end with scenes directly out of Charlottesville with David Duke talking. Like I was definitely crying in the theater. Like
it was devastating.
It was. And then they ended. The credit song was Mary Don't You Weep by Prince. Like the whole thing. Like they really brought it around to show.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you can watch this whole movie and think, oh, this is the 70s. It's like the early 70s. It's a period piece. It's long ago. But David Duke is still around, and yeah, you can, like, the film draws a straight line from there to where we are now, and it's incredibly, I mean, the footage of Charlottesville that is used is devastating and powerful.
Do you think that the film does draw a straight line from the events of the 70s depicted here to Charlottesville? Because I have to say, at the end of the main action of the film, you know, after that scene where David Duke, you know, gets the big news, and then we cut to news footage today, I was thinking, wow, you know, I don't think there's as much here about how we got from the 70s, like how the Klan never went away, how white supremacy, you know, dressed itself up in Dockers and polo shirts, you know, or now shops at, you know, American Eagle or whatever. Oh my God, I'm showing my age. But, you know, like I didn't think there was as much of a through line, because I think the film allows us like that, a feeling of triumph and satisfaction and resolution after the conclusion of the investigation, Ron's investigation. So to then jump to Charlottesville, I was like, yo, how about let's talk about how these systems never went away, because it's not just about these few bad actors, right? Let's talk more about how, you know, law enforcement, you know, enables and supports the growth of these organizations. Let's talk about the fact that, you know, apparently, you know, there were some dudes from NORAD, you know, and from Fort Carson who were in the KKK. Like, hello? Did anything ever happen to those dudes? Like, I wanted there to be more of a sense that, like, you know, hey, none of these people went away. A couple of them did. But here's how this movement grows from this to this. It seemed like a jump to me, I guess.
I mean, I guess for me, like, because the final shot we have with Ron and Patrice is the cross burning. It's not the triumph over David Duke. It's like they're still out there. That, you know, Ron and Patrice cannot let their guard down. Like, this is the world that they live in. The transition didn't feel jarring to me. It felt rooted in, like, as like what Anita mentioned earlier, how there's all these echoes and peppers throughout the film of things that echo the rhetoric of Trump or of, you know, modern times. I mean, of course I would have loved. I think that the story's scope is somewhat narrow, right? And I think that I think that a lot of the things you're talking about fell outside of the scope of the story that Spike Lee wanted to tell here.
Yeah, I mean,
but of course,
I think that maybe part of the reason why it felt like a shift to me is because it's such a shift geographically, right? So our story takes place in Colorado Springs, and because it's such a hyper localized story. It's so geographically specific in certain ways that to then transfer to Charlottesville, like I get the larger point about this is a larger national problem. You know, this is not something that like these types of hate groups are not located in just, you know, one area of the country or among, you know, one class strata of the country. But to go from Colorado Springs to Charlottesville, like I needed more because I knew what was going on. And like you say, like it's a two hour and 15 minute movie. It's not a, you know, 8-episode HBO miniseries. So what am I even complaining about? I don't know. Maybe because I thought the movie was so good, I wanted it to be even better.
Yeah, totally. And I agree with Carol here. I feel like the, in terms of filmmaking, like I think that they actually did in terms of a very narrow storyline, which is not a bad thing. That's how stories are made. That they were able to sprinkle enough of like, don't you see, this is the this is where we came from. Don't you see that we're going forward and with this horrible shit? It's not going away. It's not just of this time. But it was small, but I think relevant and pointed, like very pointed. At least I was in San Francisco. The audience that I was at very much vocally understood those references. There were groans. There were tears. There were like all kinds of stuff.
Absolutely.
I saw it in my Lily White suburb. So as you can imagine, had a couple people walking out of the film. I think one of the things that was great.
What were they expecting?
Listen, Jesus. What's so great is that, you know, I'm like, okay, I don't know what you thought you were going to get, but you absolutely got it. So whatever. But, you know, the film, the rest of the audience was deeply engaged and you know, like loudly laughing and gasping at certain things. And they were absolutely here for the pointed, explicit call out of Trump in this film. You know, like I was wondering, because like I said, I live in a Lily White suburb and it is a very conservative area by and large. And so I was like, I wonder how this is going to play, because oftentimes people who, you know, whether they're conservative or sort of nominally liberal, they don't like to, you know, have you come right up their driveway and be explicit about your protest. So I was wondering how that was going to play in the theater, but people were there for it. They were cheering.
Nice. All right. We don't have, I really want to talk about some of the stylistic choices.
I do too. Like,
but we don't, we gotta move on, unfortunately. Yeah. Maybe we'll, how about we talk about it in the bonus?
Let's do it.
Great. Yeah, because Spike Lee has very specific styles, and I think there's an interesting thing that happened in this film with that, but we have run out of time. So let's move on to our freakouts. Who wants to go first?
My freak out this week is Twitter. And about
what's
but in
Twitter?
In a good way. I actually I quote about this morning. So I'm constantly rewatching the same old stuff over and over again and getting new wonderful feelings from it. And so I've been, you know, rewatching some old Star Trek in the mornings when I eat breakfast. And this morning I was rewatching two episodes from the original series, The Menagerie. And just real quick summary, it was a way for the showrunners to use some footage from back when Christopher Pike, who was the original captain of the Enterprise before that role was rewritten and recast with William Shatner, to use some footage they had filmed from some of those initial stories. So in the episodes that I was watching, The Menagerie, Spock sort of goes rogue and diverts the Enterprise. And we learn that the reason is that he wants to take Captain Christopher Pike, who is by now, who has been in some horrible accident and is now confined to like a space wheelchair and is largely mute and disfigured, to take him to this planet where he can live free of his body, you know, from the constraints of his broken body, I believe they say. So I'm watching this, and this is an episode I've seen many, many times before, but it rang differently to me this time. I consumed it in a different way, like literally taking it in. I processed it differently, and that is largely because of the fantastic work of some of the disabled scholars and activists that I found through Twitter. And I was just like struck. Like I literally stopped short as I was watching these episodes this morning, eating my disgusting oatmeal, because I was like, yo, I've watched these episodes I don't know how many times before, but it never occurred to me to really unpack the way that Christopher Pike is treated once his body once he's no longer able-bodied. The way that the character is positioned in the shots, the way that he is moved bodily from place to place, not under his own autonomy, not by his own choice, the way he is literally voiceless, and the way that his destiny is determined for him, and also the way that the show suggests that there could be nothing worse than to live in a non-able body. And I just, you know, I was like, man, there's so much out there that I would never have thought of if it were not for the fantastic work of just these like fucking real life rock stars out there schooling idiots like me. Excuse me. See, I shouldn't even say the word idiot. This is how I'm learning, y'all. I'm learning slowly. Anyway, just shout out to some of the people. Like I said, I tweeted about them this morning. Velissa Thompson, Dominic Evans, Alice Wong. Y'all are out there doing just amazing work. So thank you for doing what you do, slowly opening folks' eyes. That's my freak out for the week.
Yeah. All right, Carol.
I'm cheating this time. I don't really have like a really solid freak out this week, but I will say that so before Black Klansman, before the screening that I went to yesterday, among the trailers there was a trailer for If Beale Street Could Talk, which is the upcoming film by Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight. If Beale Street Could Talk is his adaptation of a James Baldwin novel. And I've seen the trailer like on YouTube before, but this was my first time seeing it on the big screen. And I know it's like I don't usually like trailers. Usually they're commercials, right? And I don't usually like to rave about a trailer. But to me, this trailer is particularly effective and powerful and meaningful because juxtaposed with these images from the film, which do look, you know, beautiful. And I mean, they like, it's clear that Jenkins' sort of attention to period detail and everything is tremendous, and that the film just looks gorgeous. But what most of the talking in the trailer is actually a voiceover from James Baldwin himself. It's narration. It's him saying, you know, things like, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact words, but, you know, I used to feel that my pain and my suffering were, you know, unique in the whole history of human existence. And then I read books, and it was then that I realized that it was that pain and suffering that connected me to everyone who was alive or who had ever been alive. And just somehow hearing Baldwin's voice himself talking about the importance and the power of stories over this trailer for like a cinematic adaptation of one of his stories, I just found that tremendously effective, and I couldn't be more excited about that film. Not both because I love Moonlight. I mean, you know, I love Barry Jenkins as a filmmaker. I've loved him since before Moonlight, actually. But also because I can't imagine this story being in better hands, and I just can't wait to see what he does with it and how the film turns out.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to go through a couple of freakouts quickly. Sorry. I have to issue a correction. Last time I was on, I talked about Marlo, an album that came out,
A
hip hop album. Yeah. And, it's a collaboration with L'Orange and Solomon Brigham. I thought Marlo was the name of the rapper, and it was these two people who were working with him, but the rapper is Solomon Brigham.
Oh.
And their collaboration together is called Marlo. Whatever, listen to it. It's good. All right. I just, you know,
it's good. No, it's good to issue a correction.
Last night I went to see Jessie Reyez. I don't know if I've ever talked about her on the podcast before, but I really, really love her. She is a musician out of Toronto. And she has an EP called Kiddo, which I think is just solid through and through. It's really, really good. Check it out. And I was so tired and did not want to go to a show and had been home for very few hours. And the show was so late because it was out. It was an after show from Outerlands.
Oh, shit.
Outerlands. Jesus. Outside Lands.
Outside Lands, yeah.
She's delightful. She has a song called Body Count, and in one of the lyrics says, I dodge dick on the daily, and someone in the front row made her a hoodie that said, I dodge dick on the daily, and so she put it on when she was singing that song, which was cute. She also has a song from years ago on this EP about how when she was sort of new in this industry, she would be told that she needs to suck dick to get ahead. And so she has a whole song about that. And so she prefaced that song with like, who's heard about Me Too? Who's heard about Me Too? Just over and over again, like making sure the audience is there. And then after she performed that song, she got everyone to chant Me Too is not new. Which was, you know, really kind of powerful in this space. The other thing I'll say about the show is I definitely on this podcast have complained about how SF audiences fucking suck and how they ruin shows and they talk the whole time. There's something really special about being in a, you know, it's a smaller venue. It's not like a big, it's not seated. It's like a general admission, smaller venue. Jessie Reyes isn't like a household name yet. So the people there like know her and like know her work. Like they were singing along to every song and like, they weren't as annoying because everyone really wanted to be there and really like was engaged with this artist. And that was a really nice reminder that audiences could not be shitty.
Like, don't go to a show unless you actually want to watch the fucking artist, you know? Like, please.
Dude, for real. Real quick, I did a couple of escape rooms at Gen Con. I actually did a lot of escape rooms, but there were two that I did that I thought were so good. They're by CU Adventures. I think they're at CUAdventures.com. They're in Urbana, Illinois. I don't even know where the fuck that is. But if you get a chance, check out their work. They're really, really good.
Yeah, CU Champaign Urbana. CU Champaign Urbana.
Champaign Urbana, yeah. Exactly. Whatever.
Yeah.
Good, whatever.
Canadian.
But they're really, really well done, smart, innovative puzzles. And I just had a delightful time playing.
Did they have like narrative elements to them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have not done an escape room in a long time. And I think that the whole... I think that they just have gotten, if anything, more kind of intricate and sophisticated in the years since I've done one with, in terms of like working narrative stuff in. And I would love to.
There's a really good one here in SF that I haven't done, so we should do that.
Sweet.
And lastly, I've been trying to catch up on Elementary. I'm watching the fifth season, and I forgot how much I love those characters. I don't like procedurals. I don't like Ebony's talked about, I don't like when the state is always like, let's get your guy kind of thing. But I just love this iteration of Watson and Sherlock. So I'm having a good time with that.
Do you also like that I was there for you with the catch up text?
Yeah, because I skipped a couple seasons.
Everything that you missed.
And so I put a little group chat together and I was like, what happened? Explain to me why. Why is Watson living with him again? Tell me all of the things. So shout out to Ebony for being my pop culture know-how. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyways. All right. This week's listener freakout is from Steph Fisher and Amanda Wong in Toronto.
Hey, Anita, Ebony, and Caro.
It's Steph.
And Amanda.
And we're freaking out over Kim's Convenience.
A Canadian TV sitcom about a Korean-Canadian family, the Kims, who own a convenience store in downtown Toronto where the show is also filmed.
The main cast includes Mr. and Mrs. Kim, also known as Appa and Oma, and their grown-up children, Jung and Janet, who are in their early and mid-20s.
So why are we freaking out over Kim's Convenience?
Because representation matters.
The show puts Asian-Canadian actors in the spotlight, but it also does a brilliant job of positioning the supporting cast members as the ones who are othered, not the Kim family, and they're unapologetically funny doing it.
Yeah, this show is hilarious, and I think it's really important right now for media to show an immigrant family doing the same thing that all families are doing, you know? Like, just trying to make a life for themselves and their kids.
Didn't Appa say that in his 2017 Canadian Screen Awards speech?
Maybe. You'll just have to Google that speech and find out. But if you do, make sure you have some tissues on hand.
You can binge watch seasons 1 and 2 of Kim's Convenience on Netflix.
Okay, see you!
If you want to submit your own freakout, which we would love you to do, go to feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's F-R-E-Q. Out. All right, y'all, that is our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be talking about Crazy Rich Asians, and we'll also have a very special guest, Daniel Orthberg. Those are different episodes. Tune into both of them. And be sure to subscribe so that you always get the episodes, no matter what the topic is. Remember that you too can join our podcast community and help us bring Feminist Frequency Radio to you every single week at d.rip/femfreak. And hey, Carol.
Hey, Anita.
You know what helps us a bunch?
When people leave reviews for us on iTunes.
How did you know?
I feel like I've heard that somewhere before. I don't know where.
It really helps us a lot for algorithm reasons.
Yeah.
So, you know, and we like reading your comments about how you're enjoying the show. And if you don't enjoy the show, don't leave a comment. That's how this works. All right. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of our news. You can find me at Anita Sarkeesian.
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
I am at Steve Buscemi's other brother.
Our producer is Phil Serkis, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Norales, and art by Jamie Varon. Thanks, y'all. We'll see you next week.
Later. Bye.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, Feminist Frequency Radio heads. Did you know that some of the cheeky crew behind the podcast you just listened to are also responsible for a wild weekly movie show called Cinema Ball? It's a nostalgia fest, it's a competition, and it's usually very, very absurd. In the game of Cinema Ball, Carol and I battle to connect one random movie to another through a director, actor, producer, or someone else who worked on the film in a high-stakes game for bragging rights as the resident cinephile of the Feminist Frequency office. So join us every Friday as we turn down the lights and pull back the curtain on the films we're watching, from the schlockiest B-movies to the snootiest highbrow independent cinema. You can find it on feministfrequency.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.